Welcome to the Truth to Power Show and Radio for Brooklyn. I'm here with my co-host Jessica Mehta. Welcome, Jessica.
Hi.
It's April 2nd, 2024, but we'll be airing this Sunday. I think I believe it's April 7th, 2024. We're here with Jyoti Gupta. Jyoti is a DEIB content engagement consultant working with pre-K 5 teachers, caregivers, content makers, and their communities. Her independent book, Different, Differenter, Differenter, Differenter. Sorry, I'm messing that up. Activity book
Yes.
about skin color has been included in specialized K2 anti-racist resources on or in social justice books, Rethinking Schools Planner and McGraw Hill's Wonders Cultural Competency Curriculum for Educators. So welcome, Jyoti.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much. So now you have a new book that's coming out. So we can talk a little bit about the title Different Differenter. And then we can talk, and then we can kind of guide into your new book. But for now we can talk a little bit about the first book.
Yes, so the first book is called Different, Differenter, an activity book about skin color. And I published that, self-published it around 5 years ago. And the idea behind the book was to have authentic and real conversations with children in obviously age-appropriate ways, but more importantly, telling them some very basic facts about skin color that are regularly omitted from several communities of color across the globe. I am from India, and that's where I grew up. But once I moved to the US, and I had been already working on the idea of skin color discrimination, also called colorism, for several years. And well, by the time I decided to do this book, I'd already been working on colorism for 10 years. And in the process, I had spoken to several other folks from communities of color, particularly mothers, and parenting experiences, childhood experiences. And I just figured that there's just such little information about skin color that children actually get. I'll share a quick anecdote in which a parent was asked by a child, that like, why don't I look like you, or why don't I look like my brother? And instead of answering the child directly and saying, well, that's basically because, we have different, just like we have a different nose, different eyes, we have different colors of skin, and that comes from melanin, which is, and go on and talk about melanin. Instead of doing any of that, the mother just snubbed the child and said, what are you talking about? It doesn't matter what color you are, it just matters, what's inside your heart. So something like that, some didactic explanation was provided. And I'm assuming there was some colorism already prevalent in the family. And, with regards to who's light, who's dark, and how conversations happen within the family. And so I think the mother was, in because of that, not able to address. And this happens all the time across communities. And so I was a young mother myself at the time, and I was like, this does not make sense. Like, why don't children know more information? And even from books, like, lots of things were being omitted. So right off the bat, the book talks about skin color and melanin, and talks about how if you go in nature, you have different leaves, and when you pick up an apple or pick up red fruits, there are different kinds of colors of red. And so, kind of trying to normalize the idea that there's not just one kind of brown, So that's, and I mean, that's the basic piece about skin color, being direct about skin color. And the second piece of the book, which is equally important, is the pedagogical stance in which not only are we trying to raise critically conscious children who are able to use the information provided to them, and make their own meanings and make their own interpretations, but also use art activities to be able to do this. So, if there's an art activity and they're immersed in the art activity and they're thinking about things and there's free talk going on and there's no right or wrong answers, it really opens up the space for children explore the question properly.
Yeah, I
So
should
yeah,
say
that's.
also. I should say also, it's interesting how in that anecdote or in that story, the mother was trying to give like a heartfelt answer, but that wasn't helpful because it wasn't addressing the immediate concern of the child. And like, the concern of the child was like, how is this appearance coming differently? And like, even though it was a good attempt, but it's interesting how the science actually helps a little bit more, to give a more full explanation. So then we can ground a more grounded explanation can be more helpful because these colorism is a fact, and like giving a more grounded scientific explanation is more helpful, I think. I can see how that can be more helpful. So it's good to articulate that. And then in the second example, now we're moving into culture and how you'll be moving into culture, how culture might be an influence on perceptions of people. Because nowadays, I think I hear a lot about, when we talk about differences between people, the differences are rooted both in appearance and in culture. And like, it's not just now, I think the next conversation is going to be about culture. But you can tie together what you're saying at the end with what the next conversation is going to be about. If you continue that train of thought, you're just continuing and then continue to how, where is it leading towards? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I love how you're framing that because it's differences are based not just on appearance, which is a very significant part of who we are, race, hair, skin color, facial features, and gender self-expression, abilities, and all of that. That's part of like just the physical person. But also other facts like how's person dressed, how they've made their hair, how they are talking, their accent, language, chosen language, and so much more that comes with us everywhere we go. So culture is definitely something that was also mentioned and comes up in the first book, but I wasn't able to fully explore it. And I think now is such a great time to talk about culture too, because now we have the frameworks and the basic understanding of why talking to children is important about these things in the first place. So we have that framework post George Floyd. There was this big anti-bias children's books global, like I don't know what to call it, like a moment, where everybody was like, I need to buy anti-racist children's books. So we've had that, and the gains have been few and far between, but I think it still lays the groundwork to continue this conversation. So for me, like I was studying my second master's when all of this was going on, and my research also led me sort of in that direction of like what things that, I mean, and the research has been prevalent. It's been there, it's sitting there for people to use. But there's a 19 book from the 1990s. I believe it's called Race in the Schoolyard, but I'll send you the exact title to put in the notes. And there, the author talks about, Dr. Lewis talks about other factors like clothing and language, of course, religion, I think she mentions also. And so these are all folded into our culture. And like we have been talking about culturally relevant pedagogy, culturally sustaining pedagogy, culturally competent pedagogy. So we have been talking about these things. And I think that this is a great time to go deeper into it. And then there's also the part about this national discourse that's now happening around there's two kinds of things happening, right? So there's a diversity, equity, inclusion pushback that's going on with book bans, and I've heard other horror stories of what propagandists are calling DEI now. I believe
DEI.
it's, yeah, like diversity, equity, inclusion.
Oh yeah.
So they've like tried to appropriate the term in their own ways. But But so there's one, on the one hand, you have book bans and this pushback legislation, and this legislation, anti-trans legislation that's going on. And these are all broader topics within culture, race, gender, abilities. They all are under one umbrella of diversity, equity, inclusion, right? And so we have this national pushback going on. But on the other hand, we also have this beautiful conversation out of Berkeley about the idea of belonging. You know, that they've come up with this new term, that the B in my bio stands for belonging. And it's not, belonging is cultural belonging too, you know. I mean, it has many facets to it, the way they explain it, but a big part of it is cultural belonging. So if we connect with each other in the day-to-day, when we meet people, when we become friends with people, there's so much more to people that we have to understand and appreciate, and appreciate the differences, and appreciate that, you know, they have a different mindset, a different way of thinking, way of life. And that's how we move forward in life, you know.
Yeah, it's
So the
amazing.
idea is,
I was looking there 1 second. Self-expression, you're talking about how expression of the cultures and archetypes rather than stereotypes. Like, when we think about cultural expression, we have these preconceived ideas of like biased ideas about how a culture can express itself. Like when we see African American, or we see an Indian American, or we see a Middle Eastern American, we have these preconceived notions about how they might express themselves, and being able to open-minded to these archetypal understanding rather than a stereotypical understanding, understand that, there's a tendency, a cultural tendency, as well as, without being boxed into a stereotype, the expression can mutate or can change itself within various contexts, is what I'm getting from what you're saying. Also, how we might be challenged by that expression, or we might question, ask questions about that expression. That might be something to key in on, how we can show curiosity around how that expression might change within certain contexts. In the schoolyard, for example, would be one example of like one of those contexts you were talking about.
yeah, absolutely. Yes, I love that. You know, I mean, leading with curiosity is really such a great way to live life. You know, so many aspects, and it resonates. So often media shows us the stereotypical images of, you know, how people are clothed and how they talk. And we've heard of, in Hollywood, people talking about, you know, we only get these kinds of roles, or we don't get certain other types of roles. You know, America Ferrera has spoken, Viola Davis has spoken about it, you know. And so many Latinx actors have spoken about it too, you know, how typically, like, either they are hypersexualized, you know, the Latinx actors are hypersexualized. And on the other hand, you have Black actors who are typically given roles of, like, where they are being shown as the oppressed, you know, someone who doesn't have power, even when they do have power, right? In real life, people are doing things, you know, they're going to the moon and doing all kinds of, women of color are doing those things. So there is a stereotypical, yeah, it's, and so the media does it, and then the children learn it from the media, you know, they just absorb all of it. My son, he's 10 years old, and a while back, we were taking the subway, and he said something like, "Oh, the music was too loud," something about loud music, and he was like, "Ah, I'm not going to be carrying my boombox and blaring the music." And I was just like, "Wait a minute, let's just unpack that. Where, what's a boombox, you know? What is that? And why, how did that, like, what's the image, you know?" And so I had to break it down with him. And then eventually I told him that this was a racist stereotype that was being used, you know, for maybe in the 90s, maybe even 2000s, you know. I remember when I first moved to the US, I saw the subway had those little signs of, like, this person carrying a big thing, and a cross sign over it. And I'm like, that's so dated because I haven't seen that, you know? So why is the sign still here?
Yeah, ironically, I feel like the Spike Lee movies are the first thing I think about when I think of the boombox. Ironically, I mean, like I think of his movie, the one I forget what it's called now, but it's like where they're all in the street and they're playing the music. It's kind of strange how, and but then also how that got carried away, how that got picked up by cultural media and all this kind of thing, and the general urban legend, kind of like the community talking, people talking, communities talking. How they got picked up into the stereotypical image of like sitting on the street corner, kind of a thing, playing music, kind of stuff,
Yeah, but also like if I'm wrong, maybe I'm wrong, but wasn't it also considered disruptive and uncivil, sort of, if you're doing, okay, yeah, that's what I, yeah, so there was the, you know, the Black Pride part of it is the good part, but then the stereotyping part of it is the problematic part. So yeah, yeah, I mean, they just pick it up. I mean, we could talk about all the reasons why children learn all of this, and then parents, you know, parents say these things without thinking, and the children just wrote, somebody told, another parent shared with me something about a child walking up to another, to a new Asian kid in class about like comparing skins and being like, your skin is yellower than like yellowish, you know? And so this was not, I mean, of course, for the teachers, this was an out and out racist comment, you know? But for the child, I don't know what, because they probably read a book, you know, where something like this had been said. So there are all of these things. And I think part of my, you know, so to talk briefly about my book, it's called Yesterday, Nexterday, an activity book about culture. And the premise of the title, as you can tell, is that, you know, culture is not a static thing. And we are always transforming. Culture is never, ever static. It's just the culture at the time. But people assume it to be like a rule book of some sort, you know, which it is not. And if you start thinking of New York and families in New York, I mean, no two families look alike, honestly. And there are families where there are parents are from different communities, different backgrounds, ethnicities. And we have to create, there are single families, there are families where there's two moms, two dads, and, you know, I could keep talking about different variations of what a family looks like. But you know, so I want to create, with the help of this book, this kind of normalizing of the fact that we are creating our culture as we are going along. And the point of creating that culture is not then saying, this is my culture and this is not my culture. You know, it's not again to polarize, but it's to move towards the idea of belonging and saying that, yes, this is my culture and it's slightly different to yours, and that's what makes our culture, our community, a vividly colorful cultural entity, you know.
And I think with America being like understanding that it's a melting pot, it's a salad bowl, it's a all these different metaphors, that it's a meeting ground for all these different cultures to come together. It's, we understand America is very much very American to be like amalgamation of many different things, and very much in the sense that we understand that everyone's coming from a different place, and in New York especially. Do you understand that everyone's coming to a different place, and it's all, it's kind of mixing of a meeting ground between all these different cultural traditions.
Yeah, but to your point, I mean, I think New York does such a good job of doing that, where people can show up like in whatever clothing they want, and you know, no one will look at you twice and be like, why are you wearing this attire? You know, why are you wearing this headdress or whatever, you know? But at the same time, I mean, if you start looking at it structurally, there is not, you know, the structural piece is missing in that sense. So you know, some cultures are better than others. Some people are better than others. Some st talking styles are better than others. Some people are smarter than others. Some people are more intelligent than others. Some people have to wait. Some people can be cut in line, you know.
Are
And
we
so
talking
there
about the
are different
structural
ways about,
piece? Are we talking about the structural piece? Can you clarify that? The
like
structural.
when I mean structural piece, I mean like how society is structured, you know, that there are hierarchies in society. And what is considered as the mainstream or considered as the dominant culture, right? Again, New York is not like the rest of the country. But at the same time, like if you start looking at books and literature and museums and popular culture and TV shows, like the white majority is normalized. You know, everybody else is the other. And so that's like one of the first media literacy media studies principles is like us and them, you know, the majority and the minority. And who has the power, you know, to make decisions, to call it what's cool, what's not, you know, what's okay, what's not. So that's what I mean. So for instance, if my son goes to school, he goes to public school, local public school here, and initially, you know, this whole idea of like who's American, you know, what is an American name? My son's name is an Indian name. Is he American or not? Children have to kind of cross that bridge, I think.
Especially I remember growing up, they used to have those cups with different names on them, and you know they only have like this mainstream names on them. This is one example of how you might encounter that in real life. Like I would never see VJ on those cups because is that considered a mainstream American name, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. So in classrooms they have cups like randomly prefabricated, pre-printed cups.
And
Yeah,
it's
that can be
really fun,
quite alienating. Yeah, and that can be quite alienating for children, you know, growing up. And so the parents then, it's up to the parents and teachers and other resources to make those connections for them that are not being made otherwise. So that's what I meant when I said, and so and structure just goes deeper and deeper, you know, like it can just not for children. Well, I mean, you can talk about children disciplinary measures. There's plenty of research out there that says that, you know, black children, for instance, get harsher punishments for the same act in schools, and then darker skinned black children get even harsher. So if you took a subset of, you know, mixed kids and then black kids get, then if you get harsher punishments, if you take a set of just only black children, then you notice that darker skinned black children actually get harsher school, harsher punishments, even they're little, you know. And if you go up further in age, you know, disciplinary measures, school to prison pipeline, you know, and then you can go all the way into the incarceration, you know, the system. So it sort of all lines up like that, you know. And of course, I mean, one of the earliest things I used to talk about when I first started talking about colorism was like job market, you know. Two people show up for the same job. One is lights. So there's race element where if it's a white person, a black person, equally qualified show up, who gets the job. And then there's the color issue, which is if two people of color, same qualifications show up, who gets the job? You know, the lighter skin.
I always felt like identity is a little bit of a qualification. I know like that's a contentious thing to say. Your identity is a little bit of a qualification. Because like if you're a woman, you're competing against all these different qualifications. You're living a different life. Like for example, if you were when we think about a qualification, right? That I have a PhD in such and such, or MA in such and such. It means that you have experienced something, and it's an indicator of how you think, right? So your social identity is also something you experienced, and an indicator of how you think. So it's like I would go so far as to say you're. Social identity or marker is a qualification, and like you know, I don't know. I'm not sure how much that lands with you, but it's something that you know when you think about equally qualified, There's no such thing as equally qualified. Like, one, your identity is part of your qualifications, I would argue. But what do you think about that? Or would you agree, or would you?
Yeah, I mean, yes, absolutely. I love how you're framing that too. It is a qualification, but the point is that it shouldn't be. If we are claiming to be in a, equitable society, then it shouldn't be. And you're right. But yes, it is a qualification. I have so many stories. I usually don't talk about my personal life experiences when I talk about colorism or racism, because I'm really much more focused on the community experience. But I do have a story. Once I was leading a nonprofit when I used to live in the South in Texas, and there was this one time all the EDs, executive directors, were invited to this partner event, and right next to me. And so they read the names out, and so everybody knew that Jyoti Gupta, like, I think they didn't mention my name, but they knew that, like, the executive director of this organization is in the room. And when people started interacting and talking to each other, there was another white person, a white woman, who was next to me, and she was much younger. This person kept talking to her, thinking that she was the executive director of TAI, because I think of the organization. And I think something about age must have been mentioned. I don't know how he came to the association, or maybe there were just two women there. I don't remember. But yeah, I think there was just two of us women in that room. And he just kept talking to her, and then eventually she was like, "No, but I'm not the ED, she is." And then he looked at me, and he would not speak to me. And I felt like I'm the idiot. At the time, and for a while, I was like, it's my fault because I didn't bring this to the meeting. I didn't put the correct lipstick. Maybe I didn't dress up properly. And no.
Yeah, people still have that block, mental block, to be able to see how people, how the cultural tradition, they just don't have enough information, or they don't have enough education to be able to talk competently,
Yeah, and also I think at the time I had just finished launching some interesting programming, and I think that which was very innovative for our organization. In fact, even for other organizations, they were not doing that kind of programming for members. It was a membership organization that I was a part of, and so I think there was this evidence that there's this young girl from this organization who's done this incredibly interesting programming, and she's going to be there. So I think there was information that there is this bright girl in the room there, and yet I was, he and he didn't obviously didn't apologize. I mean, I understand he was probably embarrassed and didn't know how to go from there. But at the same time, I think I'm not trying to point fingers, but I also to bring attention to how it makes others feel, like makes us feel, and it slows us down. It slows you down. A thing like that can distract you from what you're trying to do. So to coming back to your thing, like, social identity is apparently a qualification or like a marker of intelligence. That's another thing they say about classic colorism definition, is like certain people are considered less intelligent, less hardworking, less ambitious, less capable, less qualified.
But the thing, I think, like with marginalized identities, they're working against all those factors. So when they get the same qualifications as their white counterparts, they've actually worked quite a lot more to get that than their white counterparts. So in that sense, that makes them more edge, makes them a little bit more, it gives them more of an edge than their white counterparts. So they both have masters, or they both have whatever it is, qualification, then they're not really equally qualified, because one is actually, the person called a marginalized identity is actually working much harder to get that. For the most part, given the fact that the system is working against them,
Yeah, I thank you for saying that, because people don't seem to understand. They're like, no.
Yeah.
I've been in situations where they're like, no. Why do you think you have to work harder? Twice as hard or three times as I'm like, because I do.
Yeah.
And I've had a white woman, respectable, really nice person, say to me, no. No, you don't. That's just in your head,
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah,
So.
ridiculous. But let's go back to culture. Like we're taking the process of defining culture, but at the same time, wouldn't it be beneficial to like why define culture? Isn't it beneficial to like leave just a curiosity of the individual person? What is the benefits of defining culture? What are some of the benefits of defining culture? Yeah.
That's actually the right framework to use is to say that we don't need to define culture. We can create it. But I guess what I mean from the term, you know, why I talk about defining culture is perhaps defining the fact that it doesn't have a definition. You know what I'm saying? So defining the fact that you know, culture is always changing. It's not static. Also, defining what encompasses culture, you know, holidays, traditions, clothing, language, gender identity. I'm going to put gender identity in as part of culture too, because, yeah, because I mean, it's there, and I mean, my work is intersectional, so I'm not going to leave out gender. You know what I'm saying? So gender ability, all of that kind of interacts together to create a person's experience, lived experience, right? So yeah, that's what I feel like, you know, defining the idea that culture is always changing. That these are the things that make up culture. Because sometimes you don't realize. I'll give you another example from a workshop that I led at a private school in Upper East Side. And so this is a four-part series about skin color from my book. At one point, now these are obviously Upper West East Side kids, so mostly predominantly affluent white kids, some kids of color. And so the term culture came up in one of the workshops, and the children said, wait for it. They said, oh, culture, but we have no culture. And I was like, that is so fascinating. The way America has been teaching culture since the 90s, when the multicultural education thing began, in art education anyway, is that indigenous culture and headdresses and Indian culture and you know, Diwali and all of that. And now we have white kids feeling that they are bereft of culture, you know? And I was like, really? You don't have a culture? Okay. Like, and since the other kids said, no, I have a culture. My grandmom is from Germany. And, you know, when she visits, she's, you know, she gets us clothes or whatever.
Well, what is typical? Like, we think of typical American culture. We think about like McDonald's, hamburgers, 4th of July, Thanksgiving. These things are a little bit have been under attack. At least especially McDonald's have been under attack for all these different
Yeah.
fast foods and all that kind of thing.
But it raises interesting question. You know, I mean I haven't started working on the book, so I haven't like gone into all these important rabbit holes. But yeah, like what is American culture? And listen, I'm not trying to make these answers up. These answers are gonna come from the kids. I am not gonna be making these answers up. My point is to go to the classrooms and after school and be like, okay, what is your culture? Because dude, I don't know. What do I know? I'm not from here, you know. That's again, my work style is collaborative. It centers children and all of that, you know, with their permission and consent, of course. But so this kid says, and so then one kid says, well, of course we have a culture. We live in New York. We take the subway everywhere we go, which is so profound, you know, I think.
Yeah, it is good. It is good. Like New York culture is about the PT and the public transportation, about,
I mean, yeah, yeah, and then another kid said, yeah, and if we are hungry, we go to the bodega, you know, and I again, like that's so cool too, you know. So see, this goes back to like why define culture is because if we don't, now if I'm making this book and I start defining culture in terms of clothing and traditions, I'm going to make the same mistake that we've been making, you know? Because if I show children clothing is a part of culture, again, we are going to alienate white kids and being like, well, I just wear denim and t-shirt from Old Navy. That's not culture, you know? But there is, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps.
And also, like, Indian kids are not going to school every day wearing a dhoti salwar, you know, they're
Yeah.
also wearing in Old Navy clothes. So also the portrayals are so stagnated too, you know. Even now, if you look at world books, you know, this whole category of like world books, and they're trying to show the a democratic environment, and everybody's singing a song, and there's a word that's repeated in 20 different languages. But the kids are like in their traditional dresses, and I'm like, where is this place where you have 20 different kids in their traditional attire? Where is this place? Because I have not been to this place. Because in the playground, they're all dressed in same clothes, you know, they're not wearing their clothes from.
Yeah.
So you see how popular culture and including children's media culture has just ingrained these ideas about culture which are not true,
Yeah.
which are not true, but which are not representative of the culture we live in
Yeah. And also
the
how the
21st.
culture has changed over the years. We recognize the decades have changed the look of America, each decade having its own unique look and you know, and how that has evolved, the evolution of American culture. So we do see it, but it just feels like it's not as striking as so, cultures from a country. We you know from outside the country. I mean, foreign countries. American culture is quickly changing, though, and you see that evolution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like if you went to a playground in the 1980s, you would see a certain kind of a group of people. Of course, depending on which neighborhood, but let's just say a playground. But if you go to the same playground today,
Very different, yeah.
it's going to, I mean, think about migration. You know, it used to be a bi racial country, you know, in the 80s when Alice Walker came up with the term colorism. It was black people and white folks, you know. And then over the years, we had like there's been so much more Latinx population, Asian populations, and now children and children of children, third generation children, you know. And there the migration is huge. People are coming to the US for jobs in much bigger numbers, and they're mixing with the rest of the community. They're not necessarily staying in their enclaves like they used to in the 60s and 70s, you know.
Yeah.
And so if you go to a park, if you go to my local park, I live in Washington Heights, you're not going to find three kids of the same racial identity.
Yeah. I was on my wait, let me take a pause here one quick second. I remind
Yeah.
listeners of the Truth to Power Show Radio for Brooklyn. We're talking about colorism and culture with Jyoti Gupta and our co-host Dr. Jessica Doe. So we're talking a little bit about that, a little bit culture now and about also I want to bring in art so you're talking about art pedagogy how art or it's an illustrated book your book upcoming book Yesterday and Yesterday, a kid's book about culture and you're doing a crowdfunding sourcing out for that or are you doing
Yes.
it yeah.
Yes. So I'm going to, I raised money for my first book, and I'm doing that again now. Launches next week, the campaign. And as I said, you know, the process is going to be research driven, field work, meeting with children, meeting with educators, and so on. I'm super excited. I really hope the funding comes. And to your second question about art,
Yeah.
the good thing about working using art pedagogy or utilizing art pedagogy, which has been mostly historically been used for art therapy for the most part, we are still seeing less and less, we're still not seeing enough in art education where art is being used to discuss complex issues with children. But it has been done. There is some research out there that it has been done. So there are multiple benefits of, you know, how this is helpful for children. First of all, you know, it creates a very cohesive atmosphere for children to interact on a topic. It's not just about cerebral information, knowledge. You know, you can invoke lived experiences into the room. It also, like, you can, your children can bring in their whole personalities when they're talking about art, because you're talking about experiences, you're talking about food, hobbies, all sorts of things. It's not just about 2 plus 2 is 4.
Yeah.
You know, and you're not just using that part of your brain. That is also great for a classroom where certain people are always giving all the answers. You know, they know all the stuff. You know, the so-called smart kids. But if it's in the art, like when I do my workshops, I try to move out of the classroom because it frees all the other kids of those, you know, tradition. Like, who's the smart kid? Who's not? You know, children internalize all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And so moving to art sort of first and foremost, you know, frees everybody up, and now it's a sort more a different kind of a playing field that has been set up. That's one. It's obviously more fun. It's immersive. You know, it's more engaging for children. They, again, the emphasis when I do my workshops and the emphasis on the book is like there's no right answers, and there is no, the art project is not something you can hang on the wall. Like, that's not the end goal of the activity. The end goal is to create something in which you create self-expression. You are able to express yourself fully. And children appreciate that. If the pressure is off of creating this incredible artwork, they actually can enjoy the process, you know? So that's another thing, is, you know, how do you make a lesson more engaging? But most importantly, if you start thinking of really understanding where children are at on a topic, what we need from children in such a situation is to be able to answer freely. You know, so if I say to a child, what are your thoughts about the best pizza in town, you know, in your neighborhood? Or did you see this film? Did you like it? Why did you like it? They can pretty much express freely. You know, I might say, draw a scene from this film that you like the most. We saw 2 hour film, you know, draw your favorite scene. You're gonna have 20 kids gonna draw completely 20 different things, and they're gonna have 20 different talking points when you ask them what they saw and what they
Yeah.
noticed. What they noticed is who they are. It's not a
Yeah.
competition where everyone has to get a summary right. You know, is that who wins in the end, or who was, did you know if this was the villain at the start of the film? You know, like, it's not something like that. It's so when we have an art activity like that, children can actually respond to it based on their lived experiences. So it's open-ended. That's the first thing. The art activity, art pedagogy, allows children to come into the conversation where there are no right or wrong answers. It's open-ended. Second part, I think, is that it really focuses on children's intentions. It focuses on what they have seen, what they believe in, what they are hearing, right? And what they are seeing, and perhaps what they would like done differently, you know, also, because children are imaginative. If you give them the right prompt, they can actually even better a storyline and say, well, this was the story. Is so, again, another example, if you showed them a film or read them a story and said, okay, now you have 20 minutes, draw a different outcome of this storybook, they can come up with a different outcome in 20 minutes. I mean, second graders, third graders, they're just so on top of it, you know. So it really helps us understand and leverage their intelligence for their world, you know, to create a different world, because adults are not doing this properly. I always tell my son, like, we're not doing this right. So you tell me what you think about the Barbie movie, you know? Because I don't know. What do I know? You know? And so stuff like that. Again, it gives us so much information about their cultural system, their value system, what really happens in school, you know, that they won't necessarily talk about, or they're not allowed to talk about. You know, it's not politically correct to say certain, it's not correct to say certain things. It gives us ideas about how they're living their life, their perceptions. And The final most incredible thing that I've seen happen in these children's classrooms is that they can actually come up with solutions too. And that's again a very unexplored side of art pedagogy in a big way. You know, we don't get to see that. But a lot of times you can have children come to the, you know, make their little art projects, do their thing, come to the table, everybody discusses what they drew, you know, and stuff comes up. Like if you're talking about a contentious topic, stuff will come up. They will interact with each other and they will form a community dialogue about it. And yes, there's going to be confusion, there's going to be fissures, there's going to be a result of that, which the teachers have to then handle. But at least children are gaining more clarity and not hiding behind what they've heard from their parents or, you know, seen in the media. You know, we are giving them an opportunity through the medium of art, through medium of media creation. Maybe they're making a poster, maybe they're making a 1.5 minute clip. These are all the different kind of activities I've included in my first book, and I'll do more in the second.
Yeah,
But
really
yeah,
great.
it's interactive, you know.
Yeah,
So
really great. And I think also it's like the question whether there'll be a point where, going to this idea, is that you're promoting like what are we cultural competency? Like, you know, if they otherwise, it's an ongoing journey to reach cultural competency because like culture is so so difficult to define, as well as how it's interpreted by others and your gender expression or your expression of your whole identity. So, do you believe we'll ever reach a point where we can say someone's culturally competent? I mean, I don't know.
yeah, I mean that's the goal, you know.
Yeah.
That's the goal that people, you know, that we reach there. I recently shared a reel, you know. I was supposed to make this reel, and the topic of the reel that I had given myself was, you know, how important it is to say people's names. You'll see where this is going.
Yeah.
So, you know, the point of the reel that I was supposed to make for Instagram was, you know, it's important to say people's names correctly, you
Yeah.
know. You just have to get it right. And so I started making the reel and I was like, wait a minute, Jyoti, you even can't say people's
Yeah.
names correctly in the American way. Because if I say your name, like yours is an Indian name, but if I say Jessica's name, it may not sound exactly like how she likes her name to be said, you know, and maybe I'm Indianizing it a little bit. So I was like, I think we have people of color have to understand that. And that's the reel I ended up making, is that, you know what? You don't have to say my name exactly correctly because my name is Jyoti, and the dental T is doesn't really exist in American English, for instance. You know, and so if my friends call me Jyoti, but that's fine as far as I can see them making an effort to understand who I am, what I like, you know, respect my food choices, whatever, you know, come to my home, you know, appreciate what they see here and ask questions. That's all. And so I
Yeah.
ended up making this reel. I was like, you know what, say my name how you like it, but just respect me, you know. And it
Yeah.
was so interesting to have that reel out because not only did it get a lot of views, but I also had such a diverse group of people liking it. So I have this like very fierce black journalist, you know, she is like no mess, no frills person. She's like very, very articulate. And so she, on the one hand, I had her liking the post and like, yeah. And then on the other hand, I have some friends who are like professionals in their mid-40s, white folks who live in Jersey, and like they were sharing it to their page. I was like, this is gold, because like to have such a diverse audience kind of liking something, you know, is interesting. Because obviously the journalist liked it because conceptually, factually, from a racial perspective, like she agreed with the message, you know.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it felt validating to folks who were doing the right thing. Like, why are they being punished if they can't say the T sound, you know, the T sound, right?
Yeah.
So I thought that was quite, I think that's cultural, like, don't
Yeah,
have to say.
I can understand. I can understand it's close to competency in the sense of like, you know, you're being able to appreciate the individual and being able to make respect or respectfully showing curiosity around how they like their name pronounced and like trying your best and all these different factors come together to make a culturally competent person. Yeah.
Yeah, you say it better than me. When I'm ready to write the synopsis, I'm going to write to you and be like,
Yeah.
DJ, what do you think about this
Oh,
book?
thank you. Thank you. But yeah, in the last 5 minutes or so, the last 8 minutes or so, just about that. So we'll start to bring this to a conclusion about how does it all come together for you in your mind? And we could go around and be like, say a few words. Maybe Jessica wants to throw in there a few comments about how she's digested all this. Yeah.
It's not really a wrap-up, but I'm interested if any of your research or experience examines how colonization has informed colorism and other facets of what you've talked about, both in India and the so-called US, since we were colonized by the same people. And
Yeah.
I ask this because, my husband's from India, my kids are adopted from a different tribe from my own, and we've lived here and in India, so my experience has been interesting.
Yeah.
Oh my God, this is great. We need to do another interview round this time with
Yeah.
Jessica on colorism and colonialism. Yes, I have studied colonialism and the impact of that's kind of where I started my inquiry when I first did colorism work. And it's obviously very complicated. It's not something I can speak to in a very qualified way because, history and sociology are not my not my main discipline, so to speak. But in the Indian context, they say that there are like four different historical junctures that cemented colorism as we come to know it today, and this goes back a long time, so I'm going to have to remember. The first, they call it as the the Aryan invasion theory, which is the people coming from the Middle East attack, coming and settling down in India. So that was, and they were like the lighter skinned rulers, and they were very powerful. So that sort of started the process of associating privilege and power with whiteness. Then the second was the Indian caste system, which perpetrated the idea that there are four distinct castes, and caste system has also gone through its own changes. So apparently some scholars say it wasn't always like that. It became like that when the Brahmins started to make up stuff, that they felt gave them more power. And so that was when they started saying things like, oh, but the dark skinned people, and there are historical references I've shared. I mean, it's research history from a professor in India that I've shared. And I can send that to you, Jessica, via link. But the Brahmins started writing things like people with dark skin are lower in caste, they're lower in stature, and they are the, and they said that they should be in art paintings and stuff, they should be shown in this kind of a way, in a diminutive way. And so that kind of the second. The third, I think, is the colonialism, like you said, British colonists. And the fourth, they say, is like Western media, that has been a big influence also. Of course, if you and there's a great research paper about this in which it's one of a kind. They've created this term called global colorism, and in that research paper, they write about different continents. And just throwing in examples of, which continent had which kind of influence. But yeah, settler colonialism, imperialism, they all kind of come together. Yeah, it's a bit sad. I remember doing a talk in 2012, and I remember saying that, every, not just in India, which has like 30 different states and 30 different countries almost within a country, but also like globally, colorism has its own avatar. It looks the same way, it the experiences are similar and overlapping, but the historical genealogy is always slightly different. The factors are the same: power, people in power, you know. But yeah, I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm definitely going to send along the resources. And I'm sorry it's been interesting for your family and for you.
Yeah, no, it was yeah, that was helpful. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. So where can we find you on social medias and bring people
Yes,
across with
please.
you?
Yes, please come to the Colorism Project, spelled with a U, Colourism, Project, the Colorism Project. On Instagram, I've recently come out of my shell after 5 years that I've started posting. So I'd love to see you all there. Jyotigupta.com. My campaign goes live on Indiegogo next week. You can search for Indiegogo plus yesterday, next day, and that'll bring you to my page. $5, $10, $20, whatever you have. I work independently. I talk to the structural problems. I talk about things directly, not trying to hide behind cultural norms. So any money I get really does go a long way.
Yeah, speaking
Yeah.
of which, also Radio for Brooklyn supports all those independent media, so definitely want to support independent media. So please do support Jyoti Gupta on the Colorism Project and yesterday, next today. So okay, so thanks so much, and we'll do a final sign off, and we'll play a song I think in the end to delay the last few seconds. But thanks so much for being here. Okay.
Thank you so much. This was great. Thank you. Thanks for all the energizing conversation. And I'll be in touch.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Now that she's back in the atmosphere with drops of Jupiter in her head. Acts like summer and walks like rain. Reminds me that there's a time to change. Hey, hey, hey. Since the return of her stay on the moon, she listens like spring and she talks like June. Hey, hey, hey.